The content of this podcast could contain triggering information that may not be suitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised. Welcome, I'm Lauralee Binstock, and you are listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. As a victim of childhood sexual abuse, what many people may not understand is that in most cases, for the abuser, it's about power and control. They are manipulative and exploit their victims in their most vulnerable state. They create narratives in your head that they are your only safe place, and as a child, all you want to do is feel safe. My guest today knows exactly what I'm talking about. Matthew John Bocci, author of the forthcoming book, Sway. Sway is the first memoir to be published by a child of a 9/11 victim. Matt, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Lauralee. I appreciate it.
So I read the book and I was absolutely hooked. I mean, I read it in one weekend, and with kids, that's almost near impossible. It is incredibly powerful, and a lot of what you wrote were experiences and emotions and self-doubt that I have lived with for the majority of my life. What moved you to write the book?
I got sober just over 5 years ago, and when I initially got sober, I started, I went to a sober house in New Hampshire called the Granite House, and I had about 6 months at the time when one of the guys in the house told his story about being sexually abused. And then initially, I actually mentioned something to him about being sexually abused. And so that was like the first time I talked about my abuse. But then I started speaking at schools, predominantly high schools. And what ended up happening is, you know, when I would tell my story, for the most part, it would be a 9/11 type of story with a lot of spirituality tied into it. A lot of what got me sober in the first place. And but then I started talking about the sexual abuse as well. When I started telling my story at these schools, people started saying to me, well, maybe you should write a book. And, you know, I grew up journaling a lot as a kid, and I actually wrote a lot of poetry in high school, but nothing on a big level. And I never really considered myself a writer, but after initially telling my story and getting some positive feedback, I figured that I would try it out.
I honestly, and I think you and I talked about it, we thought we were going to take this event, this abuse, to our grave.
Right.
And once we actually said it, it was more than we thought it would be. You know, it was helping other people.
Absolutely. Yeah. I, like I mentioned before, that first guy talking about being sexually abused gave me so much hope, and it just, you know, lit off a light bulb inside of me that maybe other people, especially men who struggle with addiction or alcoholism, that they have gone through something similar, and that it's pretty common, actually. And so by me then getting vulnerable and starting to tell my full story, you know, like I said, I everything was like 9/11. Then I dabbled with, well, not dabbled, but I was addicted to drugs, and then eventually I got sober. And so I was able to intricately tie those two subjects together. Wasn't easy to do, but I did it. When I then incorporated the sexual abuse aspect into it, it seemingly got a lot more positive responses from people who had gone through something similar to see me get vulnerable. And obviously it was getting that off my chest and talking about it.
After your father's death on September 11th, 2001, you were on a mission to find out exactly what happened to him. That actually sent you down a rabbit hole, which led to the sexual abuse.
You know, so I was 9 years old when my dad passed away. I got home from school that day. My mom purposely kept my brother Nick and I, who was seven at the time. She kept us both in school. And I remember walking in the house that day, seeing people everywhere. The couch is full, people standing up in all different directions. It was completely packed, and everyone was on the phone and trying to call hospitals and all these different hotlines and stuff. And I remember briefly looking at the TV and seeing, you know, the images of the towers and stuff. And then I saw someone jumping from the towers. And for whatever reason, that just resonated with me. And it seemed to just have a mark in my brain that never went away. Inevitably, we find out my dad dies. You know, we knew he died, but we find out that they had identified him and found him. And that was pretty much all I knew, besides hearing rumblings, you know, and rumors in the kitchen and stuff. And my mom, like overhearing conversations my mom was having. And so my mom had purchased these two books, A Life and Time, you know, the magazines, these hardcover books that were laminated pages, and they had timelines of the day. And in the book, you know, you go through each segment of the day and they show the towers, you know, the plane hits, and then eventually gets to the people jumping. And so when I saw that first picture, that same sort of, it was a deja vu moment for me. It was probably like a year or two later. And so I just remembered back to seeing that video on TV, that image on TV, and something inside of me just like went off. And I don't really know how it started, like besides just simply looking at these pictures in that one video, but something in my brain just was like, I want to figure out what happened to my dad. And, you know, so I started asking these questions to everyone. And I started asking my mom, and I would ask grandparents and close, you know, family members, cousins, uncles, aunts and uncles. And for the most part, people really wouldn't engage because they could see how much of an obsessive, horrible quest that I was on. And that even if maybe they said, yeah, like, this is what happened to your dad, he didn't jump, I still would be searching for these same answers that I would never find. And I guess I wanted to be told something that maybe wasn't true, or wanted to be told what I didn't want to hear, maybe, is the way I view it now. And so inevitably, I have an uncle who had been grooming me for about a year or two prior. And at that point, my mom and my dad's brother, who I am very close with, pretty much cut off all communication about like that. They didn't want to talk about the jumping aspect. They both talked to my dad that day on the phone. So I asked them to, particularly the most, you know, do you think he jumped? And they would tell me no, and why they thought he didn't do that. And so this one uncle, an uncle through marriage, I guess kind of saw that his previous grooming techniques weren't really working. And when 9/11 was approached, he, with open arms, talked about it with me, you know, and there was nothing I couldn't ask him. And so eventually he told me, yeah, your dad jumped, which I've learned later on, you know, I learned years later that that wasn't the truth, but I didn't know that at the time. That's how it kind of started.
You lived with the guilt and shame of sexual abuse by this uncle. So at such a young age, you had to deal with this horrific trauma of losing your dad in such a just horrific way. What did that do to you mentally?
Well, I mean, I'm the oldest of four boys. And so I instinctively took on a role, or tried to at least, of being a father figure for my brothers. And I was always helping my mom when she was going through her struggles after my dad passed away. And I did my best as a kid. You know, obviously I wasn't driving people around at the age of 10 years old. I can't, you know, I'm not going to lie to you and say that I saved the world or did all things for them. But, you know, I tried my best to be a good role model. And when that happened, I kind of, you know, I tried to put on a facade that everything was okay, but deep down I was suffering. And I felt like a failure. You know, if I allowed this to happen to me, being the oldest, who's to say it won't happen to them? And, you know, if I can't even protect myself, how can I protect my younger brother? So I chose, which is the most popular option, and that was to say nothing. And so I lived with that guilt. And to this day, I still struggle with it, you know, especially talking about it very openly now with the book coming out and with just people who know my whole story, especially my friends. It's hard to express it into words sometimes and try to explain why you have that guilt and why you think, or you had thought for so many years, that it was your fault and, you know, that you could have prevented it, or you could have stopped it, or maybe you should have done something sooner or said something sooner. That's just kind of what happens with sexual abuse. And in my opinion, and in my experience, when it happens at the hands of a family member, it makes it so much harder to come forward, and is so easy to believe that it's your fault and that you allowed it to happen.
I do want to say that I know, even though it is hard to talk about it, in the book you articulate it so well. You really felt the pain in your struggles. I mean, like I said, you dealt with this horrific trauma from your father. You dealt with this horrible thing that happened to you by your uncle, but you also had to grow up pretty quickly to take care of your mother and your brothers. That's a lot of responsibility that was kind of put on your shoulders.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that. You thought that I articulated it well. That was actually one of the biggest sections that I had to sort of go deeper with. What I initially wrote maybe wasn't, I didn't want to get as vulnerable. I didn't want to get as detailed. And I was told by numerous people that I had to get it out there, and I did. And it was probably the hardest thing I had to write in the entire book, you know. And it's definitely one of the hardest things I have to talk about, especially when I talk about it with my family, my mom. In terms of, you know, growing up quick, I think that responsibility eventually got the better of me. And that's where I got to my struggles, my personal struggles. You know, I grew up a very, very good student, pretty much straight A student. I was pretty good at sports. And when I got into, you know, I was self-sufficient and very reliant on my own. I didn't need help. I didn't ask for help. I didn't want it. And so I got through middle school and into high school with no help from my mom. You know, she didn't have to check in on me to make sure I studied for a test or did my homework. I did everything on my own. And I went to an all boys high school, and you know, the sexual abuse happened my freshman year into the summer of going into my sophomore year. It pretty much went on for a year, on and off. I said, I went to an all boys school. I didn't want to be viewed a certain way. If I came forward about it right then and there, I knew people, well, I assumed people would judge me or think of me in a certain way or make fun of me. And not only that, but I didn't think that people would believe me either. I was told that, you know, my mom, my aunt, no one would believe me. I was just a kid, and who's going to believe you? And if you say this, you know, they're going to think you're gay, and you know, they won't think I am. They're going to think you are. And then you're going to have to go to school, and everyone's going to look at you like that. So these are all the things I was told. And, you know, being a heterosexual young man and being sexually abused by another man is one of the most mentally debilitating things that could happen, I think, to an adolescent boy. You just second guess everything, and you doubt yourself, and you judge yourself too. And so I started dabbling with drugs and alcohol in high school. I was drinking my early years of high school. I started drinking when I was like 14, just on the weekends with my friends and stuff. And it was nothing serious. You know, I didn't pick up a drink and have a you know, an epiphany and felt that my life was magically better. You know, I just was having fun with my friends. And even with smoking pot, I didn't get too crazy with it. You know, I did at times. I had phases in high school, but nothing crazy. And for the most part, it was just a recreational fun thing that I would do. And so when I got into college, though, that's when I, you know, when I picked up harder drugs, pills, painkillers, Xanax, stuff like that. That's where the guilt continued to follow me. It was so fresh and raw when it happened when I was in high school that I didn't even almost acknowledge it. But then as I got away from it, it followed me, you know? And so then I tried to forget it by getting high and getting drunk. And that's what I tried to do for a long time.
Yeah. I feel like when you go through something like that, this type of trauma, and you try to suppress it, you think, okay, this is what I need to do. I just need to not think about it. But the thing is, it'll come out in other ways. And I think substance abuse and just risky behavior is, in my opinion, a symptom of it. Did you ever think that the substance abuse was a symptom of your experiences? Or do you think that, you know, this would have happened whether or not you went through what you went through with your father and with your uncle?
I think that sexual abuse particularly ignited the fire quicker for me. I think that for the most part, I was a good kid growing up. I didn't really have many problems in school except for being like a class clown or like distracting my classmates because I used to whistle in class and like play the drums with my pencils and stuff. And besides being basically a distraction to the entire class, I wasn't a bad kid, you know, and you talk about the risky behaviors. You know, when I was using, I willfully went into the projects every day to pick up drugs. I knew the risk of going alone. I didn't carry a weapon on me. There was people I went with a lot of times that did, just for a God forbid situation. And to be honest, I kind of opened it, you know, I welcomed it with open arms. If something happened to me, I figured in my mind, well, I'd be better off.
Yeah. You know, I talked about that for me in my first podcast, and that all my friends just thought I didn't care. Like I was just a risky person and just, you know, I was all for the thrill of it. In which I later realized it was just, I didn't care. I was, you know, I didn't care about dying. I didn't care about living. I feel like sexual abuse, it really deteriorates at like their self-worth and their self-esteem. And I feel like that kind of contributes to not giving a shit about anything, right?
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And so I feel like, and it did help me when I went into treatment that it wasn't bad behavior, but it was just symptoms of abuse. You know, they told me like, oh, you know, these are just textbook symptoms of childhood sexual abuse. And then it made sense to me because I felt like I was a good kid, you know, especially because the abusers, like I mentioned earlier, they really focus and exploit you in your most vulnerable state. And, you know, all you really wanted to know was what happened to your father on 9/11. Do you think if you were given the answers you needed, the situation with your uncle would have never happened?
You know, I'm not going to blame the people who kind of withheld that type of information from me. I know they did it for the right reasons, but I think that, you know, I'd argue that, yeah, if I was given those answers, it probably would have never happened. The other part of me looks back and sees where I was as a kid then. You know, I was vulnerable. I was looking for a father figure. I was looking for someone to just talk to me about any little thing, you know, sports, girls, school, someone I could talk to who wasn't my mom. And, you know, my mom was just newly remarried at that time. And so, you know, I was very, very rebellious. And, you know, I think that if it wasn't my persistent questioning on 9/11 or what happened to my dad on 9/11, he may have found something else that would have broke me or would have made it easy. I think with sexual abuse, especially from a family member, you know, my experience is such a mind fuck in what it does to a person, in the sense of you almost have an affection towards the person and mm-hmm. you like, I, so many people in my family were so stunned because, well, for starters, you know, I would show up pretty fucked up to most family events. And so whether or not it was noticeable to everyone, that I don't know, but I was pretty cordial and pretty friendly with my abuser. And so not like, you know, on top of each other, but like, you know, I didn't make a scene. And right. So I felt it was easier to sort of pretend it didn't happen, for starters. And also I thought, well, you know what, maybe if I can pretend it didn't happen, maybe I can have a normal relationship with this guy, or maybe he'll show me affection in a different way. And I think for the longest time, I was looking to just be loved, not sexually, but just find some sort of affection, you know, from like a father figure.
Exactly.
And so being in such a desperate and vulnerable state that I was in when it happened, you know, initially my gut told me something was wrong, but at the same time, I didn't know what to do. I was so young and, you know, to be told all these things, well, you know, it's normal. It's, you know, you don't have a dad. This is like mm-hmm. trying to, you know, show you the ways. And so not only that, but everyone trusted him. You know, my mom trusted him and that's not her fault. You know, he was a world-class manipulator. And so we had like very weird instances as a family where there was like people who camp counselors, people like that got close to me and my brothers, and my other uncles would get on guard. And all along, you know, the person they should have been looking out for was the one who was hiding right there in the corners with them, you know, and trying to quote unquote protect us. So the fact that I still had an affection towards this person bothered me. But not only that, was, I don't know, it bothered me.
You know, and I've talked to many people who've been sexually abused, especially by a family member. It's way more common than people know. And that's the thing. This is a person who has taken care of you, who has made you feel safe, at least before the intimate stuff happened. And you want to pretend that the abuse didn't happen so you can continue that relationship with them.
Right.
And the more you try to suppress it, the harder and more difficult it is. And I think that's why a lot of the abuse, especially by family members, they're not being reported. Because, you know, I'm sure you went through this, but I was worried about what other people would think. I was worried about what that would do to my family. Would it destroy my family? Everything. And I thought I was doing the right thing by just not saying anything. But, you know, it came out in other ways, in right. substance abuse and risky behavior. And that pissed everybody off too.
Right.
So, yeah, so I understand. And, you know, I had affection for my dad. And, you know, there are times where when I released my podcast,
yeah.
I can't tell you how many people reached out to me and they were just like, I cannot believe that happened to you. Right. How did you guys act so normal? You know, at your wedding, you were dancing with him, right. you know, for your father-daughter dance. It's because I needed to act normal because yeah. I wanted to pretend it didn't happen.
Right.
So I completely understand exactly where you're coming from. And I think all the other people out there, many of them at least, feel the same way.
Yeah. And I completely agree. And not only that too, I think that, you know, maybe for a lot of outside people, they don't really understand how the grooming process kind of works and, mm-hmm. you know, or maybe what they see on TV, especially with in light of what's going on right now with, you know, some of these
sex trafficking
and these big names being accused of sexual abuse and sexual assault. And, you know, like my experience was it didn't happen where, you know, I knew this guy for a year and he abused me and then, oh, let's pretend like nothing happened. It wasn't like that. You know, mm-hmm. I had known the guy. He was part of my family for, I don't know, 7-8 years, actually even longer than that, like maybe like closer to 10. And so I had a relationship with him when the other attempts that he tried to do, you know, tried to like spin like weird questions at me in his way of trying to groom me, you know, it was easy for me to kind of brush it off. And then because he was a joking type of guy. So it would spin into another joke and then another joke and not sexual jokes, you know? So it was easy to kind of just laugh it off and be like, okay, that was whatever, weird joke, but no big deal. And then, you know, like when you're watching a football game and there's not anything weird going on and you're just having a normal conversation. And I talk about it in my book, like, you know, I didn't go into too many details about pre-abuse with him and my relationship. It's not like we were with each other every day, but, you know, he took me like shopping for, I had a crush on a girl when I was in middle school. He took me to get her stuff for Valentine's Day. And, you know, just, he would try to do things. He did a lot of normal things that uncles do for a long time. And then mm-hmm. I don't know if his perversions got the best of him or what you want to call it, but, or if all along he was just fooling me, you know? And obviously eventually he shifted that. So people don't really understand the severity of what goes into the grooming process of what the abuser actually does to a person or how they really set them up for it.
Yeah. Well, in your book, I know you didn't talk about him grooming you like specifics, but it did seem like he was, you know, right. I did read about him taking you out and you being in his truck, but I also, right. when you asked him about your father, I feel like that's when he was like, this is my chance. This is how I'm going to get him. He's going to be in his most vulnerable state. I don't know if his mind became more perverse. I think it was more like he found his way in and he knew how he was going to exploit you. And I think that's just.
Yeah, no, I agree. And in the interim too, he had already used ways to get me not to talk to my stepdad, not to talk to my mom, basically mm-hmm. severing ties, not severing full relationship ties, obviously, but severing ties where I can maybe be vulnerable with them or honest with them and be like, hey, like, you know, my uncle did this or said this and, you know, whatever. And for a really long time, my conversations with him about my dad were not related to 9/11. They were stories and, you know, tell me a funny story that, you know, my mom wouldn't know, or maybe a story that was a guy type of story that wasn't appropriate, you know, or just a funny joke he said or something. I don't know, anything like that. And he mm-hmm. did that for a really, really, really long time. So then when I was able to got up the courage, I guess, to start talking about 9/11 to him, he probably saw that as his opportunity. And after the first time it happened, you know, I was pretty much like, okay, I'm not going to say anything about this. Like, I'm whatever, this is weird. Like, not going to talk about it again. Just going to resume life as it is. And so when I would continue to have conversations with him about my dad, once again, not related to 9/11, he would then start to shift the conversations to it, even if I didn't bring it up. So he knew that that was his way. That was his, you know, my dad's brother, my Uncle Tony, described it as his sword to, you know, to cut down my vulnerability. That's exactly what it was.
Wow. I'm so sorry.
Oh, it's okay. And likewise for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've been through a lot, you know. And after your father's death, you know, I know that you wanted to hear all these stories about him. And it sounded like through your book that this was a man who was your hero, and he really worked hard from the bottom up to build this beautiful life for you and your family. What kind of pressure did you put on yourself to succeed and emulate your dad, even while all of this stuff was going on?
You know, I wanted to be successful at a young age. I worked really hard in high school, really, really hard. And I wanted to go to Villanova, and I had really, really good grades. My SAT scores were not that great, but I continued to work hard to try to get better SAT scores, and I got them to where they needed to be. But when I got into Villanova, that was like my first major achievement that I wanted to do or get. And when I did, I was like, okay, like I'm gonna continue to chase that. And so I got into the business school, and I was fully committed to going through the business school, getting into finance, working on Wall Street, and trying to basically live up to his legacy and continue keeping his legacy alive by making a name for myself. So I knew probably, you know, by the end of freshman year, that I hated it. I didn't really hate the idea of working there on Wall Street and whatever, but I hated the work that I had to do. I hated school. School, which used to be such a fun thing for me and something I actually enjoyed, and I loved reading. I loved doing schoolwork in high school, except for like math and science. But all the other stuff I loved. I loved writing papers. I loved all that. I dreaded college. I dreaded school, like going to class in college. I didn't dread college itself. I loved college. You know, I had a great time, and so I eventually dropped out of the business school. And even after I dropped out of the business school, each consecutive summer I still got internships on Wall Street. Basically, you know, as my addiction got worse and worse throughout college, I still was like, I gotta like live up to this. I gotta live up to this. And, you know, eventually out of school, when I got sober, I said to myself, you know, look, I'm not gonna go back to this. You know, my dad, you know, what many people didn't know was that my dad was miserable at his job and was about to quit. And so, on 9/11, my mom, when she got the call from him, was under the impression he was calling to say that he quit, not that a plane hit the building and that, you know, he was going to die. And so I started to look at that experience, not his, you know, his death on 9/11, but the fact that he was wanting to go so badly to pursue something else, something that made him truly happy, and didn't get the chance to do it because his life got cut short. I was like, I'm not going to live my life miserable every day. And I'm so grateful and proud of him. And I'm grateful for what he did and sacrificed for my family. But as a promise to him, I said that I wouldn't, you know, continue to work these jobs that I hated. And I did that in early sobriety. And now my book finally got published. And, you know, now my way of trying to emulate my father is to try to find success in my own way, which is hopefully by being able to inspire and help people. And that's my goal now.
Yeah, and I mean, in talking about your dad, you're doing it in a different way, which I think is more profound, you know, talking about your father the way you did in the book. And to me, I feel like, you know, that's better than just having a name, some success on Wall Street. I think this book is pretty fantastic and definitely something he'd be proud of.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was tough though. To answer your question about the pressure, it was tough. And when I got into drugs and whatnot, it put an added level of shame, you know, on me, because I was like, he would be disappointed in me, and this would absolutely crush him. And I look at it as, you know, I had to go through what I had to go through to get to where I am today. And, you know, I'm living a much better life than I was 5 years ago. So
Eventually, in the book, you wrote about a sting operation to get your uncle to confess.
yeah.
You know, it's a really intense scene in the book. What was that like in real time?
It felt like I had been in a blackout for a decade. You know, I it felt like a child in a sense. You know, I was sitting in this room in these child-sized chairs, you know, for what I can imagine is a room that, like a Law and Order SVU episode, where they talk to like a little kid who was sexually abused and try to get them to explain what happened to them. That's what I envisioned happening in this room. And in reality, it was me, a 23-year-old man, sitting in this little chair with a police officer on my left side and a head of the Crime and Victims Unit, I think it's called, in Morristown, New Jersey, on my right, and hit a tape recorder. And so initially, the reason why I got brought up was because a couple of days prior, he had been reaching out to me and was like asking me to call him and like, you know, whatever, like, let's catch up. And so I called him, and they had a pad and pen, and they were writing down things that I had to get him to say. And so it was hard. It was so, so hard, because I had to really be explicit and very descriptive and talk about, play out every single thing that happened to me and what he did to me and what he made me do. And it was gut-wrenching. You know, it seemed like time was on pause. You know, getting him to say all the things that happened, it was almost like unimaginable, and it was surreal in and of itself. And the moment I walked out of that room, that's where I really felt some relief. You know, that's where I really felt true relief. And I couldn't wait.
It was over.
Yeah, and I couldn't wait to get the fuck out of there either. I got it. But it was a very, very powerful moment. You know.
Well, you're extremely brave and courageous. I found after my trauma, I was able to find a purpose in my life. And, you know, it was taking my pain and my hurt and using it to help others, which really empowers me. And I truly believe that that's what you're doing with this book. I wanted to ask you about the book cover.
Yeah. Yeah.
That image is so simple, yet so powerful. How did you land on that cover? And tell me what you were thinking about and kind of describe it.
The designer is a good friend of mine, Mendela Larson. And we had been talking ideas, and this was, at this rate, it was like 3 years ago. That's how long ago we did the cover. And so we started spitballing ideas, and she started sending me some mock-ups, and there was a lot more complex ones. And I said to her, I was like, you know, what if we just did something super simple? You know, I wanted something that would incorporate the drugs and 9/11 together. And she was able to do that beautifully. And I said, why don't we take out all this background noise and just make it the towers as the drugs? And we actually ended up flipped the colors. So it would be a little bit more, you know, something that would stand out a little bit more, to have the left tower, the one my dad was in with the antenna on it, as blue because of the white backdrop. And, my goal, you know, for me, I'm not like a picky, you know, in terms of picking a book up off the shelf, but a lot of the books that I have nowadays that I buy have very simple covers. And I said that to her from the start, and she was totally on board and totally agreed. A lot of people look at the cover, you know, even people who know me and know my whole story, they don't know at first. They either see the drugs or they see the World Trade Center. Not many people see both. But then as you start to kind of explain it, I guess, you know, or they start to look at it more deeply, then they see both, you know, the dual meaning. But
yeah, I mean, when I looked online, I didn't really know what I was kind of looking at until I actually looked closely, and I was like, wow, that was a great way to capture this book.
Right.
I think it's amazing.
Yeah, I think it was truly fascinating too, because, you know, obviously my stories is those two subjects are very closely intertwined, but notwithstanding that, it's the fact that even in my addiction, I was still obsessed about 9/11. You know, I was, even though I had some of the answers eventually, I still was obsessing on it. I still would watch the same videos and look at the same pictures, almost in a way to sort of try to feel or be at peace and sort of like watch my dad's final moments, I guess, is the best way I've learned to describe it through therapy. You know, like the only reason why I would do that. They were so closely connected, and they remained closely connected for years. So I was, you know, really happy that we were able to portray that message pretty easily.
Yeah. It was wonderful. I think the book cover is powerful. Do you have a message for our listeners who may be struggling with their own demons?
Yeah. You know, my message, I guess, would be there's always hope, and there's always a light at the end of the tunnel. You know, I thought I thought one of two things consistently on a daily basis. The first being I was going to die a drug-related death, either an overdose or get killed in a bad deal. And with dying that way, I would never have confessed to what had happened to me as a kid with the sexual abuse. And being able to get on the other side of both of those situations seemed like something that would never happen, and yet it did. And so my message would be to always to try to hold on to as much hope as you can. And even when you start to feel it diminish, hold on to that last little bit of it and hope and just pray that you can get through it. And cause you can. And, mm-hmm. and I did. And even in some of my darkest moments where, you know, I thought either I wasn't going to make it out alive. I had bad drugs a couple times, and there was instances where I thought I was for sure going to die. And I'm just very happy, obviously, that I survived, but I'm happy that in being able to survive, I've been able to survive in a more metaphorical way too. You know, I've been able to get my story out there, and by me getting my story out there, getting vulnerable once again and time again with readers and listeners and whoever, it helps me. It helps me get through each day. It helps me stay sober. It helps me help you.
Thank you so much for joining me again. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. Seriously.
Absolutely. That was Matthew John Bocci, author of the forthcoming book, Sway. Please visit my website at tstpodcast.com. That's the letter A, tstpodcast.com. There you can find more information about Matt, along with his social media handles. And you can also find a link to pre-order his book, Sway, under resources, which will be released September 8th. Thank you for being a part of the conversation. I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and you've been listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. Take care.